From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about a new type of election system called Final Five voting and why some people are pushing for it during a time of deep polarization.
So sometimes you have to get to a breaking point in a system before folks are actually ready and willing to change.
Then we'll speak with a Milwaukee artist who is behind one of the city's most recognizable pieces of public art.
I try to take words, written words, and try to transform it into a visual form without words, and yet you can look at it and read and see what's going on.
Plus, we'll have the latest episode of Live at Lake Effect featuring classical guitarist Rene Izquierdo. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. There's a common saying around election time, the lesser of two evils. Many voters feel they're presented with two unideal candidates that make it difficult to cast a vote. But there's a movement that's been gaining momentum in the U.S. that's imagining a new way of holding elections. Instant runoff voting is a system where voters have a number of choices, usually more than two, and rank them based on preference. In Wisconsin, that campaign is called Final Five Voting. Sarah Eskrich is the executive director of Democracy Found, the campaign for Final Five Voting in Wisconsin, and she talked with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez to break down exactly how this system would work.
All right, let's have this hypothetical election, right? And we're coming up to the primary, and we have all of these candidates and potential candidates. Can you walk me through exactly what it would look like to pare that field down so that we even get to a final five?
Happy to. In the primary, you may have 10 candidates of all different party affiliations on one ballot. And as a voter, you go in and you pick your favorite candidate, regardless of party affiliation, regardless of your party affiliation as a voter, and regardless of the candidate's affiliation. So we see all the candidates for that office on our ballot, and we pick our favorite. And the top five candidates out of that primary election move forward to the general election, again, regardless of party affiliation.
What is it that you're looking to upend in primaries? Like, what isn't currently working?
So the big problem is that we are actually deciding far too many of our races in the primary election, where far fewer voters vote. And that means that our elected officials are only essentially accountable to that small portion of the electorate instead of electorally accountable to all of their voters, or at least all of their general election voters. I say that because in over 85% of our seats here in Wisconsin, we've already effectively decided who wins those state legislative seats and those U.S. House races, because our districts are either so red or so blue that whoever makes it out of the Republican Party primary in red districts and the Democratic Party primary in blue districts is virtually guaranteed to win.
There is this time that we're in where rhetoric is so charged, people are so dug in across partisan lines. How viable is this? Is this a moment that you all see as open to change? Is that what you're hearing from constituents?
I actually think that our current political moment demands really systemic change, like Final Five voting, because people are so frustrated. So sometimes you have to get to a breaking point in a system before folks are actually ready and willing to change. And having something that would not advantage one party or the other, but solely focus on making sure that our elections are more accountable to voters, responds to that primary concern of so many voters that they feel like their vote doesn't matter and they don't like their choices. And so as soon as we can start making those connections for people that they know there's something really, really broken, but they often don't think about the election system itself being a lever for change. As soon as they learn about this opportunity, this possibility, there's way more interest than I think people would expect. And the number of Rotary Club head nods I've gotten across the state of Wisconsin when we talk about this, and other, you know, civic venues where you're talking to Wisconsinites who don't often engage with or think about politics on a daily basis. If you can move this somewhat wonky topic out into those conversations and help them see the real possibility to change the incentive structure to solve problems, they understand that that's exactly what we need to do to help fix our politics.
All right. I have one more hypothetical for you.
Sure.
So let's say we're living in a post-Final Five world. So this is the way that we now elect politicians. What changes? Like, how does our system and government differ?
So we're actually starting to see those results happen across the country because, again, in our federalist system, states get to be these laboratories of democracy. And so we've seen in the first state to implement this combined change of opening up primaries and using instant runoffs in the general election, we've seen in Final Four voting in Alaska that the state legislature there is focused on the issues that Alaskans elected them to solve. They're not getting caught up in the hyper-partisan, polarizing debates to the extent that they have been in the past. There's been some fabulous reporting on state legislators who say, we've actually created these bipartisan governing coalitions that allow us to focus on the things that Alaskans want us to focus on because of the electoral system itself. So to answer your question in the bigger picture, ultimately, what we believe we'll see as more and more states implement Final Five voting is we'll see elected officials who are freed up in governing to do the work of problem solving that the vast majority of Americans are demanding they do, because the election system, their accountability structure, will demand that from them.
The first thing I'll just have you do is introduce yourself.
Yeah, my name is Tracy Hunter. I live in the Waukesha area, and I am a volunteer for about almost 3 years now with the group called Voters First Wisconsin.
What about Final Five specifically spoke to you? Was there like an aha moment when you came across the platform and the kind of push?
Yeah, I can remember quite well when I first understood it. So I was driving my car. I was listening to an interview about Final Five on the radio, and I don't remember, you know, where it was. And three things captured my attention. The first one was that it just made sense. They have a very specific problem they define that they're trying to fix. That's that problem with the primary elections. And the solution is a very common sense one. You can easily see how the solution addresses the problem. So number one, it made sense to me. Number two, it's nonpartisan. This was in late 2021. We were all exhausted with the pandemic and all of the division in our politics and in our country. So this was a nonpartisan thing that everybody should be able to get behind. That was the second thing. And the third thing, it was hopeful. You know, there weren't a lot of things that were hopeful back at that time, because this is doable. And it definitely could make a very substantial improvement in how we elect our congressional leaders in Wisconsin.
I'm Nathan Atkinson. I'm an assistant professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. So Alaska uses a system, instead of a Final Five system, a Final Four system. So there's an election where the top four candidates in an election will progress to the general election, and then voters will rank those candidates from most to least preferred. In summer 2022 was the first time ever that Alaska implemented the system in a special election for the U.S. House of Representatives. The election ultimately had three candidates after one dropping out. So we had one Democratic candidate, Mary Peltola, and we had two Republicans. On kind of farther on the right was Sarah Palin, and a little bit more moderate on the right was Nick Begich. In the first round of the election, Nick Begich was eliminated because he had the fewest first place votes. And so the election came down to Mary Peltola and Sarah Palin, and Mary Peltola won the election. Another way to look at this, and perhaps the way that I think we should look at this, is we can look at head-to-head comparisons. That is, if we look at just Sarah Palin versus Mary Peltola, which of them is preferred by a majority of the electorate? In this case, we can look at the votes and see that a majority of the electorate preferred Mary Peltola to Sarah Palin. But once we look at the head-to-head comparisons and include Nick Begich in there, we see a different story. So a majority of the electorate actually preferred Nick Begich to Sarah Palin, and a different majority of the electorate preferred Nick Begich to Mary Peltola. Now, how did this happen? Well, if we think about the three candidates aligned kind of on the left-right spectrum, we have Mary Peltola on the left, we have Sarah Palin on the right, and we have Nick Begich a little bit more in the center. most voters preferred either the left candidate or the right candidate, and a smaller set of voters preferred the more centrist candidate. Because he didn't get enough votes in the first round, he was eliminated and his votes were transferred to the other two parties. And so by not having enough initial support, he wasn't able to win the election, even though he was preferred by a majority of voters to both of the other candidates.
What does this mean for, or what could this mean for Wisconsin?
When we think about Wisconsin, we are, you know, kind of one of these canonical swing states where we have a lot of folks both on the left and the right. And we can see this in the Senate, where we have a Republican, Ron Johnson, and also a Democrat, Tammy Baldwin. Imagine an election where those two are competing against one another, and we also have a more of a centrist or a moderate candidate between the two of them. And we ask ourselves, with just these three candidates, what would happen in the election? Suppose that 40% of the voters prefer Tammy Baldwin. These are the Democrat voters. 40% prefer Ron Johnson. These are the Republican voters. And another 20% prefer the moderate candidate. Under a final five type system, the moderate candidate is going to be eliminated in the first round of the election. And we're going to be back to our kind of our normal election here, where we have, you know, one left-leaning candidate and one right-leaning candidate, and it kind of reduces to the normal election we have. And so there are other electoral methods that don't share this property. There's other electoral methods that are going to allow voters to rank their candidates, but instead is going to ask the question, is there a candidate who is preferred to all the other candidates by the majority of the voters? And if so, let's elect that candidate. A final five voting system doesn't do that. And there are other ranked choice voting systems that do. So if we're trying to contemplate changing to a different electoral system to kind of combat extremism and polarization, there's other systems which can do so better than a final five system.
That was Sarah Eskridge, Executive Director of the Campaigns Pushing for Final Five Voting in Wisconsin, Nate Atkinson, UW Assistant Professor, and Tracy Hunter. They all spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. Later in the show, we'll take you to the Lake Effect Surf Shop to hear music from virtuoso guitarist Rene Izquierdo. But first, we speak with a muralist who created one of Milwaukee's most recognizable pieces of public art for our series, Reflections of Representation. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This week, WUWM Eric Vaughn Fellow Nadia Kelly is exploring who is and who isn't honored in public art, like monuments and murals. Her series is called Reflections of Representation. Nadia spoke with Milwaukee native and muralist Reynaldo Hernandez. He's been creating murals around Milwaukee for decades, including one of the city's most recognizable, Mural of Peace. You can see the colorful mural of an eagle and dove painted on the mercantile lofts from I-43. Hernandez joins Nadia to share how he was inspired by the Mexican muralist movement and how working in the basement at TMJ4 helped spark his creativity.
At Channel 4, I was over like 12 years. And at that time, the average was like 10 years in one place. And you for one reason or another, you move on. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, I was in the basement, and there was no windows, and your mind goes like, it's kind of like being in prison for a while, but it's not. It was a good place. That's where you learn the professionalism. I would watch the radio side and watch, you know, the professionals, the announcers and the news department. So what happened, I was working in art department, then the news department would call, and I would become a courtroom sketch artist. They pull me out of the graphics and go down with the news car. So I was covering local and federal courts. Then after a while, they had cameras only in federal court. You couldn't have cameras. So at times, some of those cases, I couldn't be in there. I'd have to like look at the case, go out in the hallway and recreate it. So that was exciting. I got to cover some major trials, especially in federal court.
That is really, really exciting. So I think with murals, especially when I think about like your work and everything, like I often think of like how art can like tell stories and like document history. Is that something that comes up like in your work now?
Yeah, murals, to me, murals documents history throughout time. In fact, it's probably one of the oldest art forms. It goes back before the Egyptian pharaohs. You know, they had, I call those murals on their tombs. And then Native Americans in the Western, on the teepees, those are like murals to me. Outdoor art that really shows your culture and your, and that's what murals did in the beginning. It was a cultural thing. Mm-hmm. So throughout the years, you study the history of murals, those ups and downs where it would ebb and flow. And in the 20th century, there was a revival like in the 60s. In the 40s, there was murals with the WPA. If you study history of art, after World War II, then it went down. Then in the 60s, because of racial tensions and civil rights, that was a revival. Mm-hmm. It was a form of protest, and not only protest, but also showing your pride. So that's where it came from. But all the muralists in the U.S., got all their impetus from the Mexican muralists, mm-hmm. like Diego Rivera and Siqueiros and Orozco. So that's the history. And that was part of my culture, too. It's a Latin culture and African-American culture. So in the 60s, 68, there was like in Chicago, that's when the Wall of Respect went up. Mm-hmm. And then same year in California, they had the huelga, they call it, the strike for the farm workers with Cesar Chavez. So that it was coinciding where the murals were used as a form of identity and protest. And in South America, when they had like coups and overthrowing, they would go through towns with the guerrilla fighters. If somebody got shot and killed, they would put a memorial for them on a mural real quick. So that's the history I studied. So even though you're in Milwaukee and especially in winter, you can think outside the box. And I would like collaborate with LA and California, the muralists out there. They had newsletters, and that's where I would see what's going on in the U.S. So mm-hmm. I always had an interest for it, even though I was working in like a TV station.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I really appreciate you bringing up the history of murals themselves and like how they've been used to sort of represent like culture, used to, you know, protest popular culture and their role in also, you know, significant movements in history. What did that look like in Milwaukee specifically?
My first outdoor mural publicly on the South Side was, you know, I was sanctioned by the alderman on the South Side. And they would tell you, so he was running for office. So a mural is public and it, you know, it shows, it's visible. Mm-hmm. So it was on 6th in Oklahoma. And they dictated to me, you can do a mural, but it has to show Milwaukee's social problem, whatever that problem is. And at that time it was racism. Mm-hmm. So instead of showing the negative, I like to show the positive. So I showed two little kids, a little white kid, a little black kid, an American eagle in the middle with his wings around him, showing peace, showing unity. And then I had lakefront. So there's symbolism used in murals, at least back then. Mm-hmm. And it was good, but after a while it was graffitied because of the tension in the city.
Where was this mural again?
6th in Oklahoma. Now if you go there, you'll see there's a train. So some people just like decorative. Like now, to me, there's a lot of decorative murals.
So you mentioned, like, you've done a lot of mural work. You've done, like, over 50 murals across the city. And so I'm wondering, what ideas or themes usually come up, like, in your work?
The theme probably is that we're all, no matter what we look like or where we are in the world or where our parents or grandparents came from, we're all one family, and my mother, you know, she instilled that into us, that nobody's any better than anybody else, you know. And so I try to show that in the murals, that we should get along and have unity and harmony. And you can use, I used to use a rainbow for that. The different mm-hmm. colors of the rainbow was a symbol of the different peoples or colors in the world together. And then there's also symbols, the dove, you know, just simple symbols that people, no matter what language you speak, can relate to.
I really like that. The idea of like art as like a universal language and as a way to sort of point to themes that maybe necessarily can't be like captured in words.
Yeah, that's the point. I try to like take words, written words, and try to transform it into a visual form without words. And yet you can look at it and read and see what's going on. And art is interpretive. Some people can look at art, even abstract, see one thing, and somebody look at the same thing and get something else out of it. So you can make symbolisms and expand your mind just by looking at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you feel like is just like the general role of like public art, or maybe particularly murals, have in like a community? Like, does like public art serve a specific role or purpose? Like, should it serve a specific role or
purpose?
When
I first was doing public art, it was usually in like what they call now distressed areas, mm-hmm. or in a ghetto, or in certain areas where it's kind of run down. And so, especially when I first started, and then the neighbors would say, "Why are you doing that here? What are you trying to do?" And then sometimes you get negativity, so you have to persist anyhow. Just keep going. Later on, they'll come around. And so some of my murals I try to involve the neighborhood if they wanted to paint on it. I've worked with rival gangs mm-hmm. on murals in areas that was. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with in nursing homes, in senior centers, and different schools from elementary all the way up to colleges. So everybody learns. Some people put artists on a pedestal, you know, like you're an artist, I can never be an artist. But you can, just like anything, you can study and get better at anything. You might. So I don't try to compare, you know, like he's better than this person, but everybody should give it a try and they can surprise themselves. The kids really learn that I know social media is real fast and it's just, but when in the real world, you have to put your blood, sweat, and tears into something, and at the end you'll see the result. Mm-hmm. So you have to stick with something, and those are the things they can take with them throughout their adulthood. So it prepares them for life.
Reynaldo Hernandez is a Milwaukee muralist. He spoke with WUWM Eric Vaughn Fellow Nadia Kelly for her series, Reflections of Representation. You can learn more at WUWM.com. Yesterday was Mildred Fish Harnack Day here in Wisconsin, and if you don't know who that is, you're not alone. Despite the courageousness of her life's work fighting the Nazis as a founder of the Red Orchestra resistance group in Germany, much of her story has been lost to time. But her work and her courage remain a potent reminder of the power of people to overcome great evil. And in honor of her life, the Hone Bridge will be lit in red, perhaps as a nod to the Red Orchestra or to her work for the USSR. Art Heitzer is the president of the Milwaukee Turners and has been an integral part of reviving Fish Harnack's story by lobbying for the state holiday recognizing her life. He joins LegFX's Joy Powers to share who Fish Harnack was.
It's an interesting story that I would guess very few people know about. In a couple sentences, just to kind of start off, how would you describe her?
She was a working class near West Sider in Milwaukee. Born 1902, I think, who became quite involved in scholarly matters. She was not of German nor Jewish ancestry, but did become very involved in German culture, married a German scholar that they met together at UW-Madison. and moved there when Hitler was taking over, and formed the core group of what's sometimes described as the largest resistance group based in Germany against the Nazi regime.
She has the distinction of being the only American woman to be executed on the direct orders of Adolf Hitler. And I'd like to get back to, you know, why she was considered so dangerous in just a moment. But as you mentioned, she moved to Germany just as the Nazi Party was beginning to rise to power and really re-enter the public consciousness with a more kind of streamlined professional kind of politicking than they had had in the past. How did the views of the Nazis square with Mildred's politics?
Well, we don't know everything about Mildred's politics. She was certainly a progressive of some kind. But she was someone who did not accept injustice, but even more so, she was involved in being a bridge between various cultures, most prominently American and German culture. She was a real scholar, humanist. She married into one, if not the blue chip families of academics in Germany, the Harnacks, in the field of theology, science, and humanism. Her husband was studying under John R. Commons, which is a name that will mean something to people who care about the Wisconsin idea in Madison. And they had a regular group, the Friday Nighters, who would meet and discuss issues like, should there be some kind of compensation for people who are unemployed? And should there be Social Security and workers' comp and all that stuff? So they were scholars, but among many things and among many scholars, they did not accept the intolerance and the brutality and the aggression, the racism, I would say subjugation of female ideology of the Nazis.
How did they come to form what is at least now known as the Red Orchestra?
Yeah, well, let's talk about the Red Orchestra for a minute. So the Gestapo, which was a Nazi foremost police group, I guess we'd say. So they were looking for this group of people who they nicknamed Die Rote Kapelle, generally translated in English as the Red Orchestra. And that consisted of various people, many intellectuals, but also workers and people from different backgrounds, many of them left-wing oriented, but also conservatives. But they were united in their hatred and willingness to take risks, even the ultimate sacrifice, to defeat Hitler and the Nazi power structure.
Ultimately, Mildred Fish Harnack does make that ultimate sacrifice. As previously mentioned, she does have the distinction of being the only American woman to be executed on direct orders from Adolf Hitler. Why was she considered so dangerous?
So actually, I think her claim in that regard is even broader. We don't know of any men, American men, who were in that same situation. And I think it's a fair statement that she's the only American who played a significant role or was executed for being part of the German resistance, male or female or anything else. So she was a very gifted linguist. So the group published an underground newspaper, tried to reach foreign workers that were brought in to work in armaments plants because some of the German guys were already involved in fighting the war itself. She was also very much an intimate of the remaining staff of the U.S. Embassy and legation there, and provided information about Nazi war plans and armaments plans, both to the U.S., but also they provided information to the Soviet Union about the plans of Hitler to break kind of the detente they had on the Eastern Front and to invade. And so they played a crucial role. I mean, she's sometimes viewed as a spy, and that was valid, but was not the beginning or the end of what her role and the whole group did. So she was initially sentenced to 6 years of hard labor. Her husband, Arvid, was sentenced to be executed and was around Christmas of 1942, I believe. And by February of 1943, Hitler was increasingly, I'll say, beside himself as the war in the East against the Soviet Union, which they thought was going to be a big success and a piece of cake, ended up being a disaster. So Hitler was angered, and he had this American in his clutches, so to say, and did not feel that a six-year hard labor sentence, which she would perhaps have survived the war, was justified, and took revenge against the American nation by ordering her execution.
As we look at her legacy today, as it stands, you know, not just here in Milwaukee and Wisconsin, but, you know, nationally as a figure who did fight for German liberation, what do you think that legacy really is?
Well, I think, number one, it's that people can, and some people think they're obligated to take action when they see injustice, whether it's anti-Semitism, whether it's a war of aggression that killed tens of millions of people, whether it's general intolerance or lack of willingness to discuss ideas. And even when the stakes are very high, in this case, as high as they could be for the individuals in that group.
Well, she's getting some recognition now with the lighting of the Hone. I think a lot of people are looking forward to seeing that. Art, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing so much of this story.
Thank you very much.
Art Heitzer is the president of the Milwaukee Turners and an expert on the life of Mildred Fish Harnack. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll have the latest in our Live at Lake Effect series featuring Cuban-born classical guitarist Rene Izquierdo. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Live at Lake Effect is our music series featuring artists performing in the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood. We brought the Lake Effects together, along with Visionary Studios, to showcase local and nationally touring musicians. Today, we have virtuoso guitarist Rene Izquierdo. Born in Cuba, Izquierdo is a unique artist and passionate educator whose career has been dedicated to inspiring individuals and connecting communities. For the last 18 years, he's been based here in Milwaukee, leading UWM's classical guitar program. Here's Izquierdo performing in the Lake Effect Surf Shop.
Hello and welcome. My name is Rene Izquierdo. I'm a Cuban guitarist based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I want to play for you today a few pieces actually from Cuba, from my home country. I'm going to start the video with Mirándote, which means looking at you, by Eduardo Martín. He's a Cuban guitarist and composer. And he wrote this piece when he saw, for the first time, his newborn child.
This is Audrey Nowakowski from Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We're here at the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood, along with Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep, who's also a fellow Live at Lake Effect co-producer. Hey, Trapper.
Hey, Audrey. I'm here. You are here. Renee Izquierdo is here performing for us, one of the most celebrated classical composers, guitarists, educators of our times is just here playing for us in the surf shop, and what a treat it is.
Yeah, it's been fantastic just to not just hear you play, but to watch you play. And I know you've been a performer and a musician for a long time, but it seems like your passion is still constant, and it's been a real pleasure to watch you here today. So Renee, first off, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure to participate in the past in Lake Effect and to be back.
Yes, back with a new iteration here. So we are recording just a few blocks from UW-Milwaukee, where you've been teaching within the classical guitar program. So for anyone who's not familiar, can you just share how you came to be involved in that program at UWM?
Well, after I finished graduate school at Yale University, I moved to New York City, and I was having a fine life there. And they were actually looking for a guitar professor to create a guitar program at UWM. There was a collaboration between the Conservatory of Music and UWM, in which some of the guitar majors will actually take guitar lessons at the conservatory and then take the rest of the curriculum for their bachelor's degree at UWM. And Scott Emmons, who was chair back then he became dean of the School of Music, had a vision of creating a guitar department. And in June 2004, I was invited to come and play a concert and then give a masterclass to those students that were actually from the conservatory. And they asked me if I would be interested to move it to the Midwest, which it was a big change. I was pretty much West Coast, East Coast kind of guy, like flying up above the Midwest and never even landed in the middle. But I had to say that the last 18 years has been a true pleasure to be here to create one of the best guitar programs actually in the United States and one of the premiers in the world. Soon enough, if they let me, I'll make that happen. So 18 years of challenges, of getting to know the city of Milwaukee, getting to know their citizens. I love being here. The cold is a little much for a Cuban, but I learned how to dress up with time. And then now I'm actually okay. I can barely now stand the heat. So I switched.
A great part about watching you play is hearing a little bit about where each song came from. And of course, it's so clear how your Cuban roots have informed your music. But can you talk a little bit about your immigration story from Cuba to America? And I think that was in the
90s? 1995. You want the long version or the short version?
We'll take medium. Is there medium a medium version?
It's a lot. Well, I escaped communism, the socialism, you know. I wouldn't even say it's either. It's a dictatorship. So 1995, you know, my mother was asking me to come and live with her, like in the United States. I got a visa to come to the United States. And then the Cuban government was never going to allow me out. And they were finding ways to, by then I was at the Instituto Superior de Arte, which is the university in Cuba. And they were trying to find reasons because I was a deserter of the, immediately when you claim that you want to leave the country, then they send information through all the institutions that you are linked with. And they put you in the small jar of observation. And then, so the short story is that I knew they were going to expel me from the university and then I would be draft by a mandatory army recruitment. And that would be 5 years. I would lose the visa to come to the US and then I would have to do everything again. And so I knew that that was happening. I was trying to find a way out. And I have family living in Spain, an uncle that left in 1993, 2 years before me. I arrived in the United States, June 9, 1995, Friday, 7:50 p.m. Miami Airport. I remember. Yes. No, it was a wonderful experience and jogging at the same time because everything is so different. I remember the smells. Everything smelled like something, even in the cars. I was just like overwhelmed by that. So I got my uncle to send me information from from Spain, from a couple of competitions, Jacinto Inocencio Guerrero was happening in Madrid and the Francisco Tárrega. And then I applied for to go to compete, mm-hmm. and I never came back.
Well, we're glad.
Yeah, so am I. Trust me. And little by little, we got all my family out of Cuba. We don't have anyone left there. Having said that, I have to say that not everything was bad. Education was quite remarkable there. So mm-hmm. I got all the roots, and that's what allowed me when I came to the United States to be able to audition at Yale University and get a scholarship and attend for my master's and then postgraduate degree in Paris. So there were some good things that we can take from that system that works. Like, I do think that education shouldn't be a business model.
Of course.
Rather like something, because we are actually juggling with the country's future. We need to make sure that education takes the place that it belongs, to create professionals that are competent. Because the United States has always been good about bringing talent in. But we need to actually also keep building the talent.
Developing in here.
Yeah.
So enough of going around and trying to find and just buying. We can do our talent, and we can build our talent here and give the kids what they deserve, an opportunity, you know, versus just a subpar education with a huge loan. It's just that things are shifting, and education is coming into a second part, a second role, and I think it's important not to play around with that. Milwaukee, UWM, has offered me a home to create a great guitar department here. We have kids from all over the world coming to study with us, and more will keep going.
So there's a quote by you talking about how you still enjoy performing around the world because you want to be out working as hard as you can and show your students and that you're teaching by example. So can you share a little bit more about this mindset?
Absolutely. I think I told my students all the time that if you think like students, you will get a student results. And you need to think on the larger scale, the bigger picture. We were all students at some point, and we remember all the extracurricular activities and all the things that we had to do to meet all the requirements for every course. Part of the fact that I love teaching, my calling is teaching. But if I stop performing, then I cannot demand of them the same way as I would demand of myself. So when they told me I'm busy, I have this class or that class or these many papers due, I said, so was I, and I'm still busy. I can show you that it can be done. I travel all the world, I see the level that is around, I see the kids performing here, and I tell them what's happening, because also often what happens in the institution is becomes a bubble, and they are a little bit isolated with what's happening out there. And I tell them, I just came from Amsterdam, and like in here in The Hague, in this conservatory, I just gave the master class, and this guy is playing this way and that way and that way. And also styles of teaching. When you work with all other students from around the world, you are you get familiar with the latest things in your field that are happening. So my soul is in teaching. But part of that is also performing, so I can actually walk the walk and give them the best of myself and the best of themselves and the opportunity to do so.
And watching you play guitar is such a joy, Rene, the way you become one with the instrument. And it does really feel physical in a way. It's like watching someone dance. And I know your mother was...
A ballerina.
Yeah.
Did your homework.
Yeah. Can you talk about that? How she might have inspired you and is still in you? Because the way you move with the guitar is just beautiful.
Actually, I have to... my mother was a ballerina with the Cuban Ballet for many years. The Cuban Ballet is a very successful dance company worldwide. And it's quite remarkable. I've seen them growing up. I saw many of them dancing and went to many productions. But I tell you this, my mother didn't want me to be a musician.
Oh,
she was like,
really?
Son, this is a life that is an uphill battle your entire life. Just like if you need to live on top of the instrument. And she actually was, I was very good in science. Like she wanted me to be a physics major, actually. Even philology, I was a philology major, not a guitar major at the university. So it was it was something that you have when you are passionate and you like, you cannot be away from it. And it was no chance. I remember having a guitar hidden in a friend's house, which I go and play a little bit and then just come. And there was, I'm from Cojima, this town of the east side of Havana, where Hemingway used to be fishing. The Old Man of the Sea actually is based on my hometown of Cojima. And I never understood how good of a writer was Hemingway until I read that book in English. And the way that he describes everything is so real.
He's pretty
so
good.
Real.
He's
so
pretty
real.
Good.
And I, all of a sudden I had a complete new appreciation for Hemingway. I lived opposite to that restaurant that he used to go and eat, and the part that the skeleton of the fish comes out at the end on the water after it being eaten by sharks, that was like right across the block across the street from my house. So I grew up fishing, like just living by the sea, doing all kind of, I never thought I was going to be a musician, truly. But when I came to the United States, my degree from Cuba, I had to start again as a freshman. Mm-hmm. And because guitar is a skill, it offered me the opportunity to apply at Yale University. And then that's how all of a sudden I became a professional guitarist in the United States. But it was never intended to be. But however, the passion was always there, because that's what developed the skill that I was able to use when I auditioned. That's what I tell kids when they're learning music now. You never know in which ways these skills are going to be useful to your life in the future. So whatever you're doing, in whichever capacity you're doing it, just give it your very best. But just make sure that you explore as many avenues as you can to become, to find your what you're happy doing. I find myself blessed because when I go to teach, it's not work. Mm-hmm. I never feel that it's work. But having said that, you need to learn how to balance your life so you have a successful personal life, professional life, and also as an educator. So it's a balance that I'm still struggling to get. But, but you know, some things are meant to be in certain ways. And what I learned with the years is not to fight them.
Well, thank you so much, Renee, for joining us here.
Thank you for sharing your music, too.
Thank you.
Great to watch
you play.
It's
my pleasure. I mean, it's an unusual place to record in a lake effect surf shop. I've never been in a surf shop in my life. This is the first time. And it's recording a video. So
Your mom would say, you know, look out, watch your path, your track. You might end up in a surf shop.
Yeah. Well, she, you know... at the end, when she, to follow up with that, like when she saw that, you know, that's what I like doing, you know, she had no choice to let me try it, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm still at it. So I think that was the right choice.
That was Renee Izquierdo joining us for Live at Lake Effect. Be sure to head to WUWM.com and our YouTube page to see him performing his full set in the Lake Effect Surf Shop. Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep and myself are the executive producers of Live at Lake Effect. Sound engineering is done by WUWM's Jason Reavy, and thanks to our friends at Visionary Studios, a local advertising agency, for filming and editing this episode. New episodes of Live at Lake Effect are released monthly, and be sure to catch up on our past episodes featuring the Cactus Blossoms, Willie Carlisle, Buffalo Nichols, and much more. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, just download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Did you know that there are sinkholes in Lake Michigan? Until recently, scientists didn't know it, so tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about that discovery. We'll also continue our Many Voices, One Frequency member drive, so please join us as we celebrate 60 years of diverse voices on WUWM. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.